I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, Israel, Palestine, and the recent conflict, and the future of Palestine. My guest is clearly one of the nation's greatest Jewish intellectuals and spiritual political activists. As a teenager, Rabbi Lerner was a student of Abraham Joshua Heschel, a great socially responsible mystical thinker who marched with Martin Luther King. During the 1960s, he was chair of the Berkeley chapter of the Students for a Democratic Society and among the Seattle Seven while teaching at the University of Washington. Rabbi Lerner is the editor-in-chief of Tikkun Magazine, an award-winning journal of interfaith and progressive critiques of American culture, politics, and religion. And he is also a prominent author and also is one of the individuals involved with the Network for Spiritual Progressives. His most recent book is Embracing Israel-Palestine, A Strategy to Heal and Transform the Middle East, which has been praised by many individuals, including Desmond Tutu and Senator Keith Ellison and others, as the most insightful treatment and understanding of the roots of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict and offering a roadmap to bringing peace to the region. His websites are tikkun.org and spiritualprogressives.org. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Nice to talk to you.
My goal is to see if we can have a reasonable and progressive discussion about how the citizens of Israel and the citizens who are Palestinian living in the Israeli territory can live together in peace and harmony. I don't come with any political, religious, or ideological siding. And for many people who understand the history of the Holocaust and how many thousands of pogroms and purges and mass killings and persecutions and Holocaust during the Nazi era that the Jews have suffered through, it's certainly understandable and reasonable for them to want to have a home of their own. The question is, to have a home of their own that no one else is living there is one thing. To have a home of their own that was already inhabited by hundreds of thousands of Palestinians is a different thing. So you've been at the forefront of intellectual thinkers and an activist attempting to find a reasonable solution that should satisfy all parties to this conflict. And this conflict has been lingering for decades, and with each passing U.S. and Israeli administration, the situation on the ground continues to worsen, and some of the most costly operations regarding human life against Gaza throughout the conflict have now been launched under Netanyahu alone. So what is starting to become certain in the minds of some journalists and authors, scholars, and human rights activists is that the belief that Israel may have no intention to permit a UN-sanctioned independent Palestinian state and will continue to flex its muscle, act against international law, and proceed with its own agenda to assure Palestine eventually will no longer exist and become absorbed into a Jewish state. And after listening to Max Blumenthal last week on this program, there are many popular voices in Israel advocating just that. So I'd like you to take your time and speak about the most critical historical failures that you've witnessed by the American and Israeli and Palestinian leadership that have enabled the conflict to sink as low as it has during this recent Occupy Operation Protective Edge launched on North Gaza. The forum is yours.
Well, I think that you've already hit the most important point, which is that there really isn't a clear will on the part of either side to resolve this conflict. And we saw that in the negotiations that took place between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And the Palestinian Authority has bent over backwards in many respects to make sure that there would be no violence, to work with the Israeli army to try to stop any Hamas people or others who would want to take acts of violence against the Israeli army or against the settlers. But when it came down to the actual negotiations, on the one hand, you have an Israel that whose current leadership has no serious interest in a Palestinian state. And in the course of what's happened in the past few weeks, Netanyahu last Friday made a clear statement saying that he would not accept a Palestinian state. He did not want a Palestinian state that was independent in any way, that any state that could be negotiated would still be one in which Israel would have a military presence on the borders and probably in much of the West Bank. So that rules out an independent Palestinian state, and you're not going to get a resolution until there's a government in Israel that wants that. On the other hand, in those same negotiations, Secretary of State Kerry proposed something that we at Tikkun have been proposing for a long time, which is that that the settlers, those settlers who want to stay in their settlements, be allowed to stay in the West Bank, but only as law-abiding citizens of a Palestinian state and disarmed, just as the rest of the population should be disarmed, both in Israel and in Palestine. But in any event, the Abbas was not interested in considering that, which would mean trying to uproot 400,000 to 500,000 settlers in the West Bank. It seems a very unlikely scenario to ever happen. You asked what would be the terms of a settlement that could work, and I can say that would be one of the terms, is that that the settlers have to be allowed to stay there, but only as law-abiding citizens of a Palestinian state, and with Israel forswearing any attempt to interfere should the Palestinian state pass legislation that limits some of the activities of the settlers, and that also brings to trial settlers who have seized land illegally. But that's one of the conditions. Now, I think in return for that, the Palestinians, giving that concession, Israel has to agree to both apologize for its partial, not total, but its part in creating the Palestinian refugee problem, and create a joint truth and reconciliation process with Palestinians, similar to that done in South Africa, accept an international force to police the borders and protect both Israelis and Palestinians from the inevitable extremist attacks by Hamas and Israeli settler fanatics, both of which will be doing whatever they can to disrupt a settlement, and deal, make this agreement with, most importantly, with a genuine spirit of open-heartedness to the Palestinian people, as the more powerful, because Israel is the more powerful party in the struggle. So it has to approach this in the spirit of generosity, guarantee that there was no more teaching of hatred, racism in either Israel or Palestine. Each side points to the other as doing that, and each side is correct; the other is doing that. But particularly important is for Israel to, in exchange for its settlers staying in the West Bank as citizens of the new Palestinian state, for Israel to allow 20,000 to 30,000 Palestinian refugees to come back to within the pre-67 borders each year for the next 20 years. So that there is a significant exchange there in population, so that the number of settlers going into Palestine would be matched by the number of former Palestinian residents being able to come back to where they lived before, at least to come back to some kind of decent housing inside Israel. So those are some of the terms that would change the picture, and of course sharing Jerusalem as the capital of both Israel and the Palestinian state. And all of this is based on the notion that there's a desire for peace and a desire for reconciliation, there is no possibility of peace and until there is a new open-heartedness, a new spirit of compassion on the side of both peoples. Now, that may seem like a far-fetched development, and certainly in light of the news that we see today, it's far-fetched. But we also have to remember how the changes that occurred, for example, after the Second World War between the United States and Germany, when the United States took an attitude of generosity in creating a Marshall Plan for Germany and the other countries that had been decimated by the Second World War, and similarly for Japan. You had the stronger party making a set of gestures that were real measures that changed the dynamic so that within 20 years the Germans and were our allies and the Japanese were our allies, and the feelings that had led to that Second World War were largely uprooted. That can happen in the Middle East as well. We should never assume that the way things are is the only way things can be. We've seen tremendous transformations of consciousness, but it's going to take a different kind of movement to make that happen. And frankly, here I have some words to say for the left. The left is correct in criticizing Israel. Israeli behavior is unjust, immoral, violation of human rights, and that's all that the left says is correct. I would add, as a rabbi, also a violation of Jewish values and explicit violation of the Torah, which commands us that when we come into our land, you do not oppress the stranger or the other, whoever is the other there. Remember that you were the other in the land of Egypt. And that Torah command is more frequent than any other command in the Torah. Because, of course, the Torah understood the tendency that human beings have when they've been oppressed or hurt to pass on that hurt and pain to others. And that, of course, and that's what's been going on. We have two peoples, Palestinians and Israelis, both victims of post-traumatic stress disorder, and both acting out of that stress disorder in ways that intensify the worst of paranoia on the side of the other, and hence empowering the most extreme elements in each camp, who can say, you see, the other guys are really evil, and they have plenty of evidence for that. And so for Israelis looking at the murder of three teenage boys a few weeks ago was the kind of wake-up call to say, you're not safe. You're really not safe here. And that then gave Netanyahu a cover for and the outrageous actions that he took, namely to arrest over 1,000 Palestinians in the West Bank, mostly sympathizers of Hamas, but including many of the people that he had just 2 years before made a deal to free in exchange for the freedom of Gilad Shalit. And so there are activities that Israel has taken that confirm the worst fantasies of you can't trust these Israelis. And on the other hand, there was this this murder, and you know, Hamas come out and said, we condemn this. We didn't do it, and we condemn it. It's not what we want to do. Instead, there was equivocation and refusal to in any way separate themselves from that act. And there is reason to believe, at least Israelis claim there's reason to believe, that it wasn't Hamas itself, but a rogue group of Hamas people who did that murder. But in any event, that restimulates all the fears of the Jewish people. And once you've got people acting out of fear, then they empower a leadership who goes way beyond that. We saw that in 9/11 here, where the outrage of 9/11, the horrible killing and murders of so many thousands of people here, gave the United States government the public support to totally eliminate some of the most important human rights and civil rights that we had fought for hundreds of years in America, and suddenly disappearing. The right of habeas corpus, the right of trial by jury, et cetera, just disappearing. And torture, and then that used as an invasion of Iraq, which had nothing to do with 9/11. So you can see that when people get stimulated or re-stimulated back into their most fearful place, they go also into their most primitive and violent place. So we need a whole new consciousness, a consciousness that first and foremost, and this is what the network of spiritual progressives, of which I'm chair, and the Tikkun magazine, of which I'm editor, this is our primary message. We need to abandon the notion of what is called, what I call the strategy of domination, that says homeland security can be achieved when you have enough power over the other, and instead adopt a strategy of generosity. And that's a strategy that says that the way to achieve homeland security is by showing an open-hearted caring about the other. So to make that concrete, if you go to our website, spiritualprogressives.org, we have detailed a global Marshall Plan that in which the United States should take the lead, but in getting the other advanced industrial countries involved in ending once and for all global poverty, homelessness, hunger, inadequate education, inadequate health care, and repairing the global environment. We estimate that that's going to cost about 2% of the gross domestic product of the United States each year for the next 20. But it would have an incredible chance for more transformative impact on the consciousness of the world if they felt that the most powerful country in the world could act in a spirit of generosity. Similarly, Israel needs to do the same thing in relationship to Palestinian people. It needs to approach them with a spirit of generosity, with repentance for Israel's part, for the Jewish part in creating the Palestinian refugee problem in the first place, and then saying we have sinned, we have made terrible mistakes, and we want to rectify it to the greatest extent possible, consistent with our sense of our own security. And that spirit of generosity would over time, and I'm not predicting that Hamas is going to throw away its crutches and say, hallelujah, we've seen the truth. No, but I do think that over time, Hamas's support will dwindle greatly in the face of consistent acts of kindness, generosity, and caring on the part of Israel. So when people say, well, what can we do in the short run? It's always the short run. We're always living in the short run, and so many people don't look at the big picture and plan for the long run. Now is the time to act for the long run, and that means adopting a spirit of generosity, or what we call a new bottom line. The network of spiritual progressives' primary point is that we need a new bottom line in this world, so that every institution or social practice, every government policy, every corporation, our healthcare system, our political system, our legal system, our education system, they all have to be judged efficient, rational, and productive, not only to the extent that they maximize money or power, that was the old bottom line, but also to the extent that they maximize love and caring, kindness and generosity, ethical and ecological sensitivity, enhance our capacity to respond to other human beings as embodiments of the sacred, and enhance our capacity to respond to the universe with awe and wonder and radical amazement at the grandeur of all that is. That's our new bottom line, and that's what we're trying to do in the network of spiritual progressives. Apply it to the Middle East, and you have a whole new reality possible there. And so I'm saying to my brothers and sisters in the progressive world, don't just approach this but with anger at Israel and showing how bad Israel is, even though you're right. But sometimes it's more important to win than to be right. And what we need to win is an end to this. And to end this cycle, we have to speak with compassion and a spirit of generosity to both sides. That doesn't mean denying that Israel has a far greater responsibility here to make amends and to repair the damage that it's doing now and the outrageous acts that it's doing towards the Palestinian people in Gaza right now really deserve a great deal of punishment. But as Mandela showed us in South Africa, there's a difference between being smart and being right. And Mandela said to his followers, we don't have to put all the people who have done acts of violence and human rights violations in prison. We don't have to do that, because if we take that stance, we will still stay out of power. Instead, we need to change the reality. And to change the reality, we have to, in some way, speak to the fears of the powerful, of the oppressor here. Now, that's a lot to ask of anybody who's being oppressed. But if you want to be, the leftists in the United States and progressives in the United States are not suffering directly right now. So we should be a model of a different kind of discourse, a discourse of compassion, of generosity, of critique, to be sure. But the critique has to be tempered with a sense of the need to reassure the people of Israel that we're not out to destroy them. And if you saw in the news in the last 2 days, crowds of mobs of people in Paris going into a Jewish suburb and screaming, kill the Jews, you see how quickly critique of Israel turns into critique of all Jews and a desire to kill all Jews. And it's precisely that is not far from the minds of most Israelis, and that leads them to be easily manipulated by right-wing crazies like Netanyahu and people far more extreme than Netanyahu that simply want to throw all Palestinians right out of the country.
I appreciate those insights. Some say that the Balfour Declaration of 1917 was the first legitimate endorsement for an independent Jewish state in Palestine. However, critics argue that there was no real legitimacy to the declaration. It was one-sided and orchestrated by Britain as a colonist power following the defeat of the Ottoman Empire, and the original residents of Palestine had no seat at the table. However, it was not until the UN vote under Truman that Israel became a true state. In your research into this history, how did the UN and the U.S. fail to assure a two-state scenario in the region?
Well, I mean, the first thing is, here I don't want to just blame the United States or the UN or the United Kingdom. I mean, the first thing is that you have to understand that whatever craziness exists amongst Jews, whatever paranoia, is a product of 2,000 years of hatred by the Christian world. And that goes all through Europe, and it goes through parts of Asia now that are Christian and parts of Africa that are Christian. They still teach hatred. And the New Testament is filled with representations of Jews that are disgusting, that if you didn't know who Jews were, you wouldn't like them. So you've got a whole cultural reality that then manifests in an upsurge of anti-Semitism in the 19th century when the new capitalist order produced a great deal of misery for working people, and the capitalists came up with the idea of nationalism and said, what we have to do is get our working people to identify with the state, with our country, and not pay attention to their suffering. But the problem is that only went so far, and people were still living under intensely bad conditions. So the ruling classes in many of those European countries then turned around and said, you know why our nationalism isn't working? Because there's a foreign element here, and that foreign element are the Jews. And that led to the rise of fascism and made it possible for fascists to come to power in the 1920s and 30s throughout Europe. So then, after the Second World War, you had a situation in which the United States would not open its door to the refugees from Europe, and most of the countries of the world were closed their doors when it was the Jews who were in the concentration camps, desperately trying to get away. And unfortunately, the Arab world played an important role in that, because the Arab world, the leadership of the Arab world, now again, the leadership was imposed in colonial leadership, the kings of these different countries. These countries were themselves created by the colonial powers. They didn't exist. There was just one Arab nation. So they created these countries of the Middle East and then imposed leadership on them. And that leadership, listening to nationalist elements in Palestine, said, okay, we will cooperate with the British and we will provide oil for Western societies, but only if you promise not to allow any Jews to come here. And so after the Second World War, hundreds of thousands of Jews are sitting in displaced persons camps that were not very different from concentration camps, except for the fact that they weren't murdering us. The Palestinian people leadership had convinced the other Arab states to use their power to prevent Jews from coming to Palestine, which was the nearest society. So if you're saying to me, well, what, you know, the Balfour Declaration, et cetera, yeah, it was illegitimate. They had no business. Who are they? They're the colonial powers. But, of course, if we want to go back there, then no country in the world has any legitimacy, because there's no country in the world that isn't a product of conquest by one group over another group. So we're starting with where we are. Israel is not going to leave. It's not going to get off the map. And the people in Israel have had the experience of walking slowly to their death, or so they inherit that vision of themselves as the inheritors of the people who walked to their deaths in the concentration camps of Europe. And they have 200 atom bombs. They are not going to go down quietly. They will. They could create unbelievable suffering and hurt in this world if pushed against the corner. So you don't push them against the corner. Instead, you have to deal with them with their pathologies. And here I fault Hamas. Here's Hamas sending rockets into Israel, targeting cities, in other words, populated areas. And of course, I totally fault Israel for doing essentially the same thing and killing, you know, 500 people at least, 500 Palestinians at least. Maybe it's more by today. It was about 500 this morning, but, you know, I don't know how many more have been killed since the last time I read. And killing lots and lots of civilians, including, I'm told, one out of four of them were children. Disgusting, terrible acts. So you've got both sides doing these terrible acts, and Israel saying, we want a ceasefire, but only if the Gazans stop shelling us. And the Gazans have said so far, no, we won't do that unless you meet some of our conditions. And their conditions are perfectly reasonable as far as I'm concerned, the conditions that Gaza has put out. But Israeli right-wing sentiment is so strong now that they don't want to stop until the tunnels have been cleared out, the tunnels that Hamas has been using to store weapons and to tunnel under the border so that they could do attacks on Israel. And until the shelling of civilian population of Israel stops. So we have a short-run problem, but the short-run problem will end at some point. The long-range problem is the occupation itself. The occupation is the root of the problems facing Israel and the Palestinian people. It must be stopped. It must be ended. And for that, we have to critique the United States for its giving a blank check to Israel in every sense, not just financial, but political. Its refusal, for example, to support the Goldstone report of the UN on the last invasion, the last big invasion of Gaza, in which many war crimes were committed by Israel. And then the United States says, no, we're not going to allow that to be brought accepted by the United Nations. We're going to use our veto power. So, yeah, I think the United States has a big role in this. And although it's pretending to be now to be a mediator, it's so clearly been on the side of Israel and on the side of not just of Israel, but in my view, on the side of the most reactionary elements in Israel. Because really, I'm pro-Israel. I am pro-Israel. I want Israel to be strong and safe. And the way for that to be accomplished is to get out of the West Bank and Gaza and, in a generous and open-hearted way, make peace with the Palestinian people. And that's precisely what isn't happening. So I believe that the greatest friends of Israel are those who are trying to push it to end the occupation.
Just a few more questions. I appreciate those insights. What are your thoughts on the failure of the UN fact-finding Goldstein report that was rejected by the United States into Israel's crimes you just mentioned against humanity in 2009. Mm-hmm. What has been the advantage of Netanyahu's government to continue its assault on Gaza when the report was not causing any repercussions for Israel? In other words, they committed crimes.
There was no consequence. Exactly, and as long as there's no consequence, then the most rabid elements within the Israeli ruling circles will continue to feel that they've got a free pass from the United States. And so, but here you have to look at the politics of the United States and see how screwed up it is. I mean, today there was a CNN poll conducted yesterday that shows that the majority of Americans support what Israel is doing in Gaza right now. Well, if that's the case, then what politician is going to stand up and take a principled stand? Well, I can tell you that there was a vote in support of Israel's right to defend itself, but of course it has nothing to do with defending itself. It's the opposite of defending itself. But there was a vote in the Senate. The vote was 100-0. That means that Bernie Sanders, that means that that the most progressive Elizabeth Warren, that all of those people voted in support of what Israel is doing right now. So all the progressives in the Senate, whoever they think of themselves as being progressive, and sometimes people in the progressive world are saying, if only it was Bernie Sanders, if only it was Elizabeth Warren. These people ended up responding to the same pressure as everyone else. If the people of the United States don't change their views, then not much is going to change. And that's what a progressive movement could be doing, is helping people re-understand that situation. That's what progressives should be doing. They should be out in the going door to door and re-educating people about this issue. Until we do that, now that's hard work. It's easier to have a demonstration, although the demonstrations are paltry and small. But it's easier to have a demonstration or to write an op-ed than to go door to door and try to explain to our neighbors that what is happening there is unjust, and it's not even what is in Israel's interest, because what's in Israel's interest is to end this occupation and get on with its life without having to be in the position of being an oppressor to another people.
Rabbi, you are far more nuanced in your analysis behind the conflict today than most, and you've attempted to delve into the complexities and histories that are ignored by the mainstream media and our governments. So given what we are witnessing today, it is too easy for the left to not look at Hamas the way they should. They're looking at Hamas as a victim of inhumane living conditions that have been created by Israel. The international community has yet to acknowledge Hamas as a democratically elected government. Yet Hamas also has failed miserably people living in Gaza. So please share your views on how Hamas has failed and contributed to Israel's wrath, and what should Hamas be doing to raise its legitimacy in the eyes of the international community?
Well, I mean, the first thing it should do is it should accept a ceasefire and should stop firing those rockets onto Israel. The second thing is, I mean, look, if you're pro-Palestinian, really pro-Palestinian, then you have to recognize that Palestine is going to have to live with Israel. And that means that what Hamas should be doing is saying, we accept that. We are not interested in pushing the Jews into the sea, because that's what it has said over and over again, that that's what it wants to do. It wants to destroy the state of Israel. It can't. It can't do that until it does. And so as long as it does that, it is the best friend of the extremists on the right in Israel. And this whole thing has helped re-legitimate and recredit the most extreme crazies in Israel, because Hamas is bombing cities, even though it's ineffectively bombing cities, but its intention is to attack ordinary human beings. Okay, Israel at least goes through the motions of pretending that's not what it's trying to do. It says, look, we're after the Hamas operatives who are bombing us and the tunnels that they are running. They don't say, we don't believe that that Hamas has a right to exist, or that the Palestinian people have a right to exist, or that that there's a, even they don't even say that Palestine doesn't have a right to exist as some kind of entity. Israel, but Hamas says Israel has no right to exist. It won't. It doesn't allow for the possibility of Jews having a homeland in the in that area. So it's got to change its tune. It's got to accept that Israel is there. It's got to say, we want to live in peace with Israel. We want the end to the occupation. We want an end to the blockade. We want a freeing of all the prisoners. We want an international community to build a global Marshall Plan here and take and end the suffering of people. We want to be able to have a Palestine that has enough economic support so that it can bring back refugees from all the places, terrible places where Palestinians are living in refugee camps. But it can't continue to say it wants to destroy Israel and then expect that it's going to have any impact but a negative one, namely the one of legitimating the most fearful elements in Israel, the most scared elements in the Israeli population, which then automatically gives the right wing the political power to commit the atrocities that it's right now committing.
Thank you for that. My final question, well, actually it's a two-part question, because it concerns the propagandizing use of the term anti-Semitism by the Israeli lobby and its allies. Now, you're highly critical of Israel as a political body, and you've received numerous attacks from AIPAC and other pro-right-wing Israeli factions.
They call me an anti-Semite.
So I want you to explain to us why those who are critical of Israel should not be perceived as anti-Semitic. And then I want you to understand that a very large percentage of this audience is Jewish. And yet most of them are very progressive regarding the world and domestic and economic issues that I cover on my program every day. However, many are also staunch supporters of the official Israeli interpretation of events and believe what the right-wing Israeli propaganda tells them, which often reduces Arabs to non-human status. For example, right now we hear repeatedly from the Israeli and mainstream American media that Hamas is using Palestinians as human shields. Therefore, bombing hospitals and schools is warranted. And, of course, there's no definitive evidence to support this. But only what the Israeli officials and the media tell us. If we imagine for a moment that the completely imbalanced show of force, it was reversed, would we imagine that the Netanyahu government and the IDF would be using settlers or its citizens as shields against Palestinian assault? Of course not. I'm sure you face the dilemma of where to draw the line between legitimate and false voices to appear in your magazine, Tikkun, based upon moral human rights and other ethical grounds. And I would not bring an Israeli spokesperson on this program just as a propagandist, as I would not bring on John McCain or Sarah Palin to share their views. The question is, what are we to believe and not believe, and what are the ethical standards you feel should be followed for who to give or not give a voice to, and how do you deal with you as a leading scholar, an ethicist, and a rabbi being called anti-Semitic?
Well, this is just the, the way it happens in politics. At a certain point, I just shrug my shoulders and say, yeah, of course, I was called anti-American when I was opposing the war in Vietnam, and I went to prison in my opposition to the war in Vietnam. So, and they're saying, sure, he's an anti-American. He hates America. I don't hate America. I love America. It's a great place. But there is some screwed up policies. And when the United States was murdering in Vietnam, I was opposed to it, very much opposed to it, and put my life on the line to oppose it. So, there is no question that people on the left, people who are critical of Israeli policy, often get demeaned and pigeonholed as anti-Israel and anti-Semitic. The two are not the same, by the way. You have to also understand that there are some anti-Semites in the left. There are some people who side with Hamas not just in saying that the occupation should end, but who think that the occupation was the very creation of the state of Israel. Okay, that is, in my view, that is not an acceptable view. And I had these debates with people from ANSWER, that organization that led some of the big anti-war demonstrations against the war in Iraq, in which I said, well, don't the Jewish people have a right to national self-determination in the Middle East? That's where they're living. And they said, no. The people of the region should decide who, whether they have that right or not. Well, that would be the same thing as, you know, the people of the region were making war against Israel. That would be the same answer. If you gave that answer about, should blacks be suffering under segregation? And somebody said, well, we should just let the people of the region decide. No, we shouldn't let the people of the region decide. The people of the region were racist. Okay, so in the South in the United States, and still are many of them. So you have to recognize that there are such anti-Semites. There are people who do not believe that the Jews are entitled to the same thing that everyone else is entitled to. And look, here you have. I can't sleep at night because of the terrible things that are happening now and what Israel is doing. But at the same time, I have to tell you, the total number of Palestinians killed, 500 or 600, is nothing compared to the number of people who are being killed in Iraq today by ISIS. And and why are the people in France not chanting death to ISIS or whatever? They're saying death to the Jews. Why the Jews? Why is it that the Jews' sins are seen as magnified so much greater than the sins of everyone else, including the sins of the United States? I mean, right now, the United States, I mean, I'd love to see some mass demonstration of progressives about the 67,000 children who have come across the border, who the government, and including Obama, are all and the government of Texas and all these other states are trying their best to figure out how to get rid of them. They don't want to kill them, but they want to send them back to where they may be killed, where they may be subject to, you know, to death or extreme violations of their human rights. Why isn't the progressive movements up in arms about that? Well, there's a disproportionate amount of critique of Jews, and that underlying that disproportion may be for some an anti-Semitism. Now, on the other hand, for a lot of others, for a lot of us Jews who are doing that, we're doing that because we care about the Jewish people, we care about Jewish history, we care about Jewish values, and we see Israel as violating those values and actually creating a mass basis all around the world for hatred of Jews. Not that hatred of Jews is ever legitimate. No racism is. No, it's never appropriate to take the actions of some of a people and then hate the whole people who are doing it. And that's why I was never anti-American, even though I hated what the United States was doing in Vietnam, and just to a lesser extent, but still in Iraq and Afghanistan. I never generalized that to say the American people are fundamentally evil. The American people should be judged by different standards than everyone else. No, it should be judged by the same standards, and so should Israel. Israel's crimes are disgusting, but they are not even close to the level of the crimes of the United States, of China. I mean, in terms of human rights violations, China, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Russia, I mean. So there's a disproportion there that is used by Jews to say, then anybody who's critiquing us is an anti-Semite, and that's not true. But I understand the sensitivity given the history.
Last question that was going to be, but I wanted you to address what happens when you see the American media so biased in its coverage and AIPAC so powerful in its persuasion that reasonable people on some issues become non-reasonable when it comes to having an open and honest dialogue. I haven't seen you on NBC debating this.
No, of course not. No, yeah, I mean, the media is totally biased, but the media is biased in part because the media in this country is always subservient to the positions of the State Department on foreign affairs. You know, almost always bends over backwards to buy whatever story the United States is putting out. But secondly, because the AIPAC, but more, even more importantly, the tens of millions of Christian Zionists, very powerful element in the Congress. That's how you get 100-0 vote. It's not just Jews. Jews represent 1.5% of the total population of the United States. But Christian Zionists, they are a very significant section of the population of the United States. What they do that the progressives don't do is they support really support with money and with time and energy the causes that they believe in. But you look at Tikkun, and we're struggling financially. Now, you can't tell me that there aren't at least 2 million Jews in this country who identify more with the progressive vision of an Israel that embodies our highest values than the values of AIPAC. But the ones who do that, put Israel as like the 10th issue of priority, and so they don't think of, oh yeah, it's an obligation for me to support Tikkun magazine, the voice of progressive Jews that has been out there for the last 28 years, articulating a critique of Israeli policy without being anti-Israel. And so we get no financial support, and we don't. And when we make a call for people to do things like, for example, go visit their congresspeople, go say to their congresspeople, look, if you keep on giving a blank check to Israel, no matter what it does, we're not going to support you. But progressives won't do that. So as a result, I've met with many congresspeople, good people, who have, you know, on every other issue, and they say to me, look, Rabbi Lerner, the truth of the matter is that the progressives you represent are going to vote for us because we support them on 10 other issues. They don't make this their issue. They don't make Israel their issue. But when it comes to the AIPAC people and the Christian Zionists who are a part of our constituency, they're telling us, and we believe them, they won't vote for us unless we support Israel in the way that they tell us is supporting Israel. Well, then, you see, so So what they've said to me straight out, okay, these are meetings of people who are powerful figures in the Congress have said to me, Rabbi Lerner, there's not a chance we're going to go with you, even though we know you're right, because there's nothing in it for us to do that. And it's only a lose-lose for us. So we will be progressive on a whole bunch of other issues, and on this one, we will capitulate to the right for rather than risk losing a section of our constituency that might on other grounds be supporting us.
You made a statement twice now, and I just have to do a follow-up with it.
Yes, go ahead.
Could you explain for the benefit of the people in this audience what Zionism is, where it started back in the 1800s, and how it differs from because a lot of people confuse Zionism with Judaism, and where they cooperate and where they compete.
Yeah, but Zionism is the national liberation struggle of the Jewish people. That's what it is. And it had, when it started, it was a national enterprise to bring the Jewish people to a homeland. And in fact, in the first 10 or 15 years, there was a debate in the Zionist movement in the 1880s and 1890s about where that should be. Because England was proposing that they would offer the Jewish people Uganda. So, can you imagine if we were in Uganda now? But the Zionist movement was simply a movement that originated out of the desire to make Jews a nation state like all other nations, have an army, have a defense against the rampant hatred that we have been facing in Christian Europe and the conditions of apartheid that we had lived in Arab lands. Arab lands were a hell of a lot better than Christian lands for us because the Arabs didn't have something in their theology that said the Jews killed Muhammad. But nevertheless, We were not allowed to participate in public life. We were forced to wear special clothes that identified us. We were not allowed to ride a horse. There were all kinds of things apartheid-like laws against Jews in many of the Arab states, in many of the Muslim states throughout the Middle Ages. So here comes Zionism, and it says, no, we can't depend on being a people amidst a minority in a majority society where the majority society hates us. We need our own state. We need our own people. And they quickly reverted to Zion, because Zion was the place that we had been exiled from. The Jewish people have had this story for 2,000 years. We had a homeland in Judea, which is built around Jerusalem, and we had a religion that came out of Judea, and we were forced out by Roman imperialism. It was the Romans who conquered that area, and eventually, because Jews were the most rebellious of all the peoples in the Roman Empire, eventually the Romans forced us out of that area. So, and Jews became wanderers in different parts of the world, wandering because wherever we settled, particularly after the Christians took power, we were being expelled. We were expelled from France. We were expelled from England. We were expelled from England in the 1200s. We were expelled from France in the 1300s. Expelled from Spain in the 1400s. We were expelled from Germany. We were expelled from one country after another. So the Zionist movement said, we want a national homeland for ourselves, and the place where we're going to do it is where we used to be, our ancient homeland. And so that's what Zionism is. Now, Zionism then had a right wing and a left wing. And the left wing was a socialist and even communist Zionist who said, we're going to build a land that is a socialist or a communist society in Palestine. And then there was a right wing that was saying, no, we're going to build a society of ultra-nationalist society. And unfortunately, because of the wars with the Arabs and the lack of willingness on the part of the people who live there, sometimes for good reason, to trust that the Jews would not take over and push them out, but sometimes not for such good reason. But as a result, a struggle emerged, and in the struggle that emerged, more and more people started to move towards the more nationalist visions of Zionism rather than the more socialist visions of Zionism, although those socialist visions persisted in kibbutzim and collective farms, some of which still exist, but most of which failed in the 1980s and 1990s for reasons having to do with the dynamics of global capitalism. I'm not going to go into it in detail right now.
Well, you've given us a lot of insights we would not have had otherwise, and I thank you very much for sharing your points of view with us today.
Okay, thank you for having me. I hope people, if they hear anything of reason in this, that they will become readers of Tikkun, at least TIKKUN.org, or join our network of spiritual progressives.
Thank you, Rabbi Michael Lerner from Berkeley, California. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you for listening.